Welcome to Oncology Today, optimizing the management of neurofibromatosis type 1 plexiform neurofibromas. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Christopher Mortel from the University of Minnesota School of Medicine in Minneapolis. In addition to this interview, there's also a corresponding video program featuring Dr. Mortel's slide presentation. To begin, I asked him to provide a general overview of neurofibromatosis type 1.
NF1 is one of the most common single gene mutations we encounter. And because it's a germline mutation, it has a different way of expressing itself in every tissue of our body. So these patients come to us not as a cancer predisposition patient, but a whole patient dealing with all the possible manifestations of this gene alteration. And so early in life, we pay attention to tumor risk, like plexiform neurofibroma, like optic pathway glioma, and of course, pay attention to their skeletal growth, make sure they don't have scoliosis, tibial dysplasia, or other dysplasias of bones. But between the age of 5 and 18, we pay attention to one thing and one thing only, school success, because we know these kids can have learning barriers from their ADHD or their autism spectrum disorder. We make sure that we muster all the possible resources we can to help them to be successful. And then beyond age 18, we're right back to tumor risk again, and we become a cancer doctor.
So you showed in your presentation a great chart, I guess, drawn by a patient of their family. What fraction of patients overall who are identified as having NF1 have a genetic history, and what fraction seem to be sort of sporadic?
Yeah, it's actually about 50-50. So 50% of patients will be the first ones in their family. And so you can imagine the difficulty in identifying these patients sometimes if they're the first. Many practitioners will just look right past their cafe au lait spots or their skeletal issues. It really takes a practitioner who has this at the top of their head to make sure they're paying attention and make sure they're staying ahead of things so the kids don't go blind or suffer skeletal problems that are going to haunt them the rest of their lives. Early intervention makes a big difference with this condition, just as it does with everyone.
So I'd like you to talk a little bit more about the biology behind this issue, your vision of it. You know, we oncologists hear about the RAS pathway all the time, you know, colon cancer, melanoma, et cetera. But now here, it's kind of in a different perspective. Again, can you sort of capsulize your vision about what's going on biologically?
Yeah, well, biologically, it all starts with altered neurofibroma and dysregulation of RAS. And then there's all kinds of other genetic factors laid on that we're still trying to learn about. Why is it that some kids go to law school and others have such significant ADHD? They can barely make it to a high school diploma. Why is it that some kids have multiple strokes and others have blood vessels that are normal? And so we've really got to learn more about these epigenetic factors. But when we look at the main pathway, it all boils down to, and I draw this pathway for my patients, from my medical students and fellows every day, RAF, MEK, ERK. And we just have to stay focused on that. And we've learned right now that if we have a high potency, highly specific drug like mirdametinib or like selumetinib, we can treat that pathway and treat it with acceptable treatment-related adverse effects. I showed you that many patients didn't have their best responses until quite late. And sustaining responses, I showed you too how patients rebound if you stop their therapy. So the goal of our therapy ultimately is to try to keep these patients on a MEK inhibitor or whatever successor drugs we find, as long as possible to modify the natural history of this condition.
So another thing I was thinking about as you were going through your talk was this term plexiform neurofibroma. Can you talk a little bit more about where the word plexiform comes from? To me, I think about complex, because it's not a schwannoma. It's much more complicated. But where is that where the word plexiform comes from?
Yeah, actually it is. And I think, you know, if you look at a plexiform in a postmortem or as a surgeon dealing with it, they do insinuate themselves everywhere. They follow nerve pathways into tissues and around tissues. So the shape is plexiform. But then, as I described to you, this is a tumor made of a multitude of different cell types and cells. You can think of it that way too.
Any intuitive reason about why you see so much of an issue with the peripheral nerves as opposed to some other location?
Yeah, isn't that something? You know, and in the olden days when you had NF1 and NF2 kind of in the same class, they called NF2 central neurofibromatosis and von Recklinghausen's peripheral neurofibromatosis. We do see plenty of stuff, plenty of manifestations in the CNS, but they're quite different from the schwannomas or neurofibromas that you'd see in NF2 or NF1. I really don't have any idea why the cranial nerves get spared. There's an interesting biology going on there, and I bet smarter people can tell you more about it than I can.
So I don't think there are too many more people who know more about this, though. But another thing that kind of struck me was the prevalence. I think you said it was 165,000 in the United States, which it kind of sounds high.
It sounds
like a lot of people. So let me ask you, when you think about, you know, I guess those 165,000 people, how many of them go through their entire lives and are never diagnosed and never have any issues? How many of them end up being evaluated and treated for some kind of complication? And at what age are they typically first treated?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I told you how in the last few years, I'm starting to encounter all kinds of women who have NF1 and didn't know it until they had their breast cancer diagnosis or until their sister had a breast cancer diagnosis. And they come into me covered with cafe au lait spots and freckles. And there are others, who just kind of slog their way through life with a learning disorder and pain, and nobody's ever clued them in why that is. If we look at when people first start to encounter physicians, it's not unusual that it happens in the first decade of life. And I described to you optic glioma, plexiform neurofibroma, skeletal manifestations. Those can happen, all of them can happen early. And in that case, that's when the first encounter happens. So a median age of around 10 is the first medical encounter.
I guess it sounds like there's actually an increased incidence of breast cancer. And you mentioned there's a recommendation for earlier screening. I mean, how aggressive is it, like kind of a BRCA situation where they need, you know, MRI screening, et cetera, even prophylactic mastectomy, or not that high of a risk?
Yeah, I don't think it's quite high enough for prophylactic mastectomy like BRCA would be. However, the NCCN has included NF1 in their screening guidelines. So it's definitely there, and it's insurance approved every time to start screening at age 30. And that's the big thing we learned. There was a very large Finnish study that showed very clearly that these women get breast cancer at an earlier age. So BRCA can happen at an earlier age too, but it's a little more spread out. I think we have to pay attention to the early age of risk for our breast cancer patients.
So what about the diagnosis of NF1? I take it you would not see anything on typical genetic testing or even more extensive genetic testing. Is that correct?
Well, many cancer risk panels now do include NF1 in their cancer risk panel. Yes. And I frankly believe, given the prevalence of the condition, that it should be part. So when you're doing a cancer risk panel in a family with breast cancer, if you don't hit BRCA, it's worthwhile screening for NF1. And I've never done the cost analysis, but you know, if you're doing a panel like that, it's pretty easy to find.
And then in terms of tissue or serum, I assume that histologically these plexiform neurofibromas are they usually typically diagnosed by an H&E?
Yes.
And so, and then I know, I guess, what are there special molecular, you were talking about, I think S100 or some other markers that further characterize it?
Yeah, and the usual pathologist, when they're laying their immunohistochemistry on these, will do an S100 stain if they really need to. If they run into a radiologically distinct lesion or a lesion that definitely has a proliferative index that's higher and has a very specific cell type, then you can see that it might be the development of an ANUP or MPNST, and that's when you've got to start looking for other stuff like the H3K27M methylation.
So I want to get more into the, you know, essence in terms of the treatments and particularly new therapies, but just to finish out in terms of this issue with breast cancer, I was kind of thinking that the pathways you were talking about, you know, like AKT, PIK3, these are biomarkers now in the advanced breast cancer situation. If you have a patient who has NF1 and they have breast cancer, do you need to think differently? I mean, most of what I hear about for, you know, PIK3, et cetera, relates to ER positive disease, but do you need to think differently about treatment? You know, we have PIK3 inhibitors, we have AKT inhibitors, and an NF1 patient, do you need to think differently about how you use those drugs?
Well, I believe we do. Nobody has ever done a systematic analysis on that. And I really do think it's time, because I told you how people who get radiation have an increased risk. So if right now we're thinking about radiation as part of the paradigm for lymph node involved disease, is there a way to decrease the risk that those patients would be exposed to? And definitely, we should start thinking about MEK inhibitors and other inhibitors to control that, rather than what we've used classically.
And then, for example, in breast cancer, do you generally caution against, you know, breast conserving surgery with post-op radiation?
I generally do, or I tell them, if we're going to do that, if you're going to give radiation, then this patient needs active surveillance for a long time to make sure we don't miss a developing MPNST in that area.
Any other cancers that are high enough frequency, particularly as adults, because, you know, we're focused on general medical oncologists as opposed to pediatric oncologists. But again, if you have a patient who's been identified to have NF1, anything other than breast cancer that you need to be thinking about?
Yep. Well, you always need to think about pheos, pheochromocytoma. And I have three patients in my practice among the many who have pheos, three that had undiagnosed NF1. And I went back to the patient's chart, and here's this patient covered in cafe au lait spots, freckles in his armpits. And I look at the chart, and every time in the examination, skin, normal, skin, normal, skin, normal. And it just drove me nuts. And eventually, somebody over there on the other side of the river got bright and said, hey, this person actually has NF1. Mortel needs to see him. it's not unusual. So pheochromocytoma is one, and then GIST. And the tale that's out there right now is that the GISTs of NF1 are not the same as the sporadic GISTs we see in non-NF1 patients, but sure enough, they tend to have very similar mutations. And I right now, I had a patient with multiple GISTs who had a severe GI bleed, and I'm maintaining him on a MEK inhibitor right now just because he tried to die.
Wow. So in terms of sort of where these people are being managed, for example, of the adult patients, for those who, you know, have symptoms or have, you know, have significant issues that require treatment, maybe there's going to be consideration of MEK inhibitors. Do you think most of them are in medical oncology practices or primary care?
Yeah, I know most of them are. And, you know, there's only a few practices around the country that take care of patients from birth to grave. I'm one of them. Are my friends at Mayo Clinic. They have a really good system of moving patients from pediatric to adult providers in Boston and LA. But there's a ton of adults out there who, once they graduate from these pediatric clinics, if they're lucky to have one in their area, are left with their medical oncologist to manage them. So with these new drugs being available now, to manage those drugs responsibly, I really think a medical oncologist should be doing it. These are drugs, you know, from melanoma therapy and things like that.
Absolutely.
So you're used to these side effects. You're used to managing them. And it's chemotherapy. What the heck? So it's going to come to adult oncologists to manage these patients. And now you're going to be taking on a whole new kind of patient. You're used to taking care of malignancies. Now, how do you take care of a chronic condition? It's like, when all of a sudden CML became part of practices, you know, what is it, 20 years ago now, all of a sudden, instead of people going to transplant, now you've got people on imatinib for decades. And it's going to be very similar with these patients on MEK inhibitors for many years.
In a strange way, it kind of reminds me of desmoid tumors, at least clinically,
yep.
That they're benign, but yet they often require treatment. There now are treatments, thankfully.
Yes.
It sounds like an important issue, getting back to the medical student or docs in practice, is more awareness about the skin manifestations. Can you talk a little bit more about what exactly a cafe au lait spot is, where they occur, and also about the freckling?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, cafe au lait spots can occur anywhere on the body. And interestingly, if you biopsy a cafe au lait spot, which we've ended up doing in people who might have mosaic NF1, that is post-zygotic mutations that can happen, we see that there's a double deletion of the NF1 gene, that is a co-mutation, if you will. And that's what happens in all of the tumors in NF1. You've got the germline mutation, then all you need is the second NF1 mutation to turn the tumors on. And so when we biopsy these, we definitely see the NF1 mutation. In early in life, you only need a cafe au lait spot that's half a centimeter, 5 millimeters, to and 6 of them to make the diagnosis. Later in life, they have to be 1.5 centimeters or greater, and again, 6 of them. Freckling is very similar, and I pointed out when I was telling you about the rhasopathies that one of the rhasopathies that we knew as Leopard syndrome in the old days, and now Noonan syndrome with multiple lentigines, is characterized by freckles all over the place. The freckles in NF1 are diagnostic if they're in skin fold areas like armpits, beneath the breasts, or in the inguinum. And cafe au lait spots, frankly, can occur anywhere. It is kind of funny that they tend to spare the face for some reason. I do have some people with cafe au lait spots on the face, but most do not. Most of them have them on the trunk.
What about the clinical presentation of the plexiform neurofibromas in terms of locations, of symptoms?
So they're always located around nerves. And there are many people, and you think about the big nerves then. So you think about the brachial plexus, the lumbar plexus, the sciatic nerve is very frequently involved. Think about big nerves and you'll find most of them. And then there's some people who have what's called a spinal form of neurofibromatosis, which I hate to think about because it's tough to live with, but they basically have neurofibromas in each of the nerve roots going down their spine. And so those can proliferate or grow over time, grow out, or they can actually grow in. And those are the ones that can cause spinal cord compression. And it can happen at any level.
Incidentally, any sort of epidemiologic clues about the sporadic cases?
No, it's just an unfair mutation. And because this gene is so huge and the mutations can happen anywhere because of the conformation of the protein, it's just bad luck, just bad luck. And by the way, there's no racial predilection, no ethnic predilection at all. Every country in the world has the same gene mutation rate. And I see people from every background, every race in my clinic.
So what about local management of these plexiform neurofibromas? Obviously, surgery is a possibility. I assume radiation is not even a thought because of the malignant potential there.
Correct.
Any other innovative approaches to local management? I know they're very, you were saying it's very likely they come back anyhow, but mm-hmm. any situations where local therapy is very helpful?
Yeah, you know, I generally discourage local therapy if they're just trying to debulk these tumors. I think that's just a foolish thing to do. And when the surgeons have been through that, they always agree with me. But there are some, and if you look at the labels, the label for selumetinib says unresectable plexiform neurofibromas. The label for mirdametinib says plexiform neurofibromas not amenable to surgery. And that's a word game, isn't it? But I think it's the right way to say it, that you can, sure, you can do surgery, but is it the right thing to do? And is this particular tumor really amenable to that kind of intervention?
How often do you see these patients, you know, maybe in a community setting, actually going for surgery without a diagnosis? They don't figure it out until they do the surgery.
Yeah, I think I've encountered that in my clinical practice probably about 20 or 30 times during my career. And you can see my gray hair. And so I've definitely seen it happen. I've definitely had patients come to me because they'll have a mass on their scalp. The mass will be removed by a plastic surgeon or a dermatologist, and oops, it's a plexiform neurofibroma. And then they come to me and we make a diagnosis. And the last patient I saw like that was 13.
So I want to get more into the issue of therapy, particularly the use of MEK inhibition. You talked about two MEK inhibitors in particular that are now approved. Can you talk about, I guess, first, historically, what happened with the study and approval of selumetinib, and then more recently with mirdametinib?
Well, yeah, I appreciate you asking me that question. I've had a very close association with the Children's Tumor Foundation for years. They're the main funding and advocacy group for neurofibromatosis and schwannomatosis. And years ago, they brought together a group of scientists and clinicians, and we called ourselves the Drug Development Initiative. That until then, there was nothing, and there was a great deal of frustration with the drugs that we tried not working. And so in one room, we had people who did tons of work on NF mice and NF in test tubes, and they knew the biology very, very well. And we sought out drugs that would interfere with that biology. That's when we learned that MEK actually was a target. And so we found drugs. This is back when selumetinib and mirdametinib were brought into the laboratory. They were shown to be effective, and they were brought to clinical trials. And so we really owe a great debt of gratitude to the Children's Tumor Foundation to bringing that mind trust together. And then there was the creation of centers out within and outside the National Cancer Institute to run these clinical trials. And And of course, they were supported by the NIH. But without that, I think we would have been in the soup. So both of those drugs followed a very similar pathway. You brought up desmoid tumors earlier, and they have the drug for desmoid tumors, and now they have a drug for plexiform neurofibroma. So a lot of gratitude has to go out for shepherding that drug along and for shepherding mirdametinib along.
Yeah, another analogy to desmoid that I see was in desmoid, again, and I think there was one advocacy group that really was important in getting that getting the definitive trial done. And it sounds like this advocacy or the group that you talked about was very important here. One other thing before you, again, you get more into MEK is I also wanted, before we go too much farther, to bring up the issue of malignant transformation. Your graphic, you referred to it. You told me the whole name, but I know it's MPNST. But I know it's a malignant form of NF, I guess, one. Mm-hmm. And your talk goes through sort of biologically what happened. But clinically, where do you see these malignant tumors and how are they treated?
Yeah. Again, MPNSTs can happen just about anywhere where there's a nerve, right? And so we are constantly surveilling our patients for those. And here are the three things I ask every patient to watch for. Number one, pain that wakes them from sleep. That's pathological pain. We all know it. And plexiform neurofibromas usually don't cause that. A new mass that's rapidly growing. Plexiform neurofibromas grow, but they don't grow as fast as an MPNST. And somebody living with a plexiform neurofibroma or with NF knows when they've got a new mass that's really taking off. And then number three, plexiform neurofibromas cause nerve compression that you don't usually see with a plexiform neurofibroma. So people can have downstream pain, you know, referred pain, if you will. They can develop weakness or numbness. And if we see that, then we really look hard for a tumor that's growing quick and compressing nerves.
And how are these treated?
Well, right now it's kind of a toughie. You know, we've tried multiple chemotherapy regimens and really haven't had a huge amount of success. Surgery is always number one. And if you have a large proximal tumor, that can be a very difficult surgery. More distal tumors sometimes are even treated with amputation because we know the recurrence risk is great. Our current treatment paradigm here at my center is to do a needle biopsy. If it's an MPNST, then we give local radiation and then we do surgical resection of the radiated tissue. And then, of course, because of the radiation, now we have to surveil the patients constantly. There is a subgroup of patients with NF1 who will get multiple MPNSTs, multiple primary malignant neoplasms. And so those patients really have to be watched carefully. And we're doing all kinds of things, like trying to develop liquid biopsy, for instance, so we can surveil them with blood tests. And if we see unmethylated H3K27 come up or something like that, then we know to go after those patients and look for where their new one is.
That's fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about what we know about selumetinib from the clinical research that's been done? It always catches my attention when I saw entire papers just on management of side effects of selumetinib, which kind of made me think, wow, this may not be so easy to use. But anyhow, let's talk about what we know about, and maybe that applies to mirdametinib too, but can you talk a little bit again about in terms of what we know about its efficacy, the duration of treatment, and the impact of treatment both on the tumor as well as tolerability?
Sure. Well, selumetinib, we definitely know based on the SPRINT trial and now this subsequent adult phase two that was done, that we've definitely got patients benefiting from the medicine. Their tumors are shrinking, and they're shrinking enough to help them with their pain and their quality of life. And so imagine having a tumor on your neck or face and shrinking it enough so you can actually be out in public and look people in the eye. Imagine having pain that resolves so you can actually be engaged in going to the store, participating in sports. We know that that works. Patients, and this, you've asked the million-dollar question, how long? It's probably literally and figuratively a million-dollar question, but patients who embark on this therapy, if they come into my clinic and I'm talking to them about starting therapy with this drug, part of the conversation is making a contract to be on the drug a minimum of 18 months. And during those 18 months, I'll do my best to control side effects, and they'll do their best to be adherent to the schedule and stay on the medicine. And when we're controlling side effects, we talk about diet, because I told you nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea can be an issue with these things. So we know that having a kinder and gentler diet will be easier for patients, something like a Mediterranean diet. If you've got any hint of lactose intolerance, eliminating milk and greasy pizza. So dietary guidance is really important. And I do have some patients on MEK and RAF inhibitors who I do give ondansetron to initially in their therapy just to get them through that period. The next most important thing is skin. And I told you about these acneiform rashes. And boy, if you want to lose a teenage patient as a friend, put them on a MEK inhibitor. So we start very early with our pubertal and adult patients. We start them on doxycycline before we start the drug. And darned if that stuff doesn't work. So if they take doxycycline for the first 3 months, then after that, the occurrence of that acneiform dermatitis goes way down, and they tend to do pretty well. Some people may need some spot welds with clindamycin ointment, and we definitely tell people to stay clean, taking a bath, really soaking yourself. And in younger kids, and this is a common therapy for severe eczema, take a bath with a half cup of bleach in the bathtub.
Wow.
And bleach baths really work. They reduce the bacteria count on the skin. And then they come out and you kind of pat dry them. You don't dry them off completely. And then you put on a really good emollient ointment, something to really provide a good skin barrier. We actually did some work on pigs with NF1. We created an NF1 pig with a company locally. And when we look at skin in NF1, ERK is way upregulated. And I think it's true in people who don't have NF1. ERK is a super important chemical for maintaining skin integrity. So if you're giving a MEK inhibitor and downregulating ERK, you're just going to have skin that is not as good as it's been.
So I don't know how much sunlight you have there in Minnesota, but what about skin sensitivity? Do you keep people out of the sun?
Yeah, interestingly, with RAF inhibitors, I've definitely seen skin sensitivity with vemurafenib and dabrafenib, but I haven't seen as much skin sensitivity with selumetinib and mirdametinib. I did have some early experience with trametinib, and some of those patients had some skin sensitivity, but in my clinical practice, it's not a big deal. But hey, we're oncologists, right? So everybody should be, and you live in Florida, of course we have to be careful about our skin. So you want to wear the right clothes and use the right sunscreens anyway.
So you might find it interesting as a reflection of what's going on in medical oncology that we're about to do. I think this is the third time a program just on ophthalmic issues in oncology. You've heard about cardio-oncology, just ophthalmic, you know, there's some ADCs, yep, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think that MEK inhibitors should be on the list? And what do you actually see there? I kind of vaguely remember, was it central serous retinopathy or some type of retinopathy?
Yeah, it was first described in all the old folks, and that's why we're doing eye exams on all the young people, not finding it. It was definitely seen in a lot of the early trials with older people with melanoma taking trametinib or mirdametinib or selumetinib. So it's just kind of bled its way into these pediatric trials. But yeah, it basically is a vaso-occlusive retinopathy that becomes serous. And you can definitely it's been reported that there's been retinal detachment in patients taking these drugs.
So another question about selumetinib is you showed some data now with adults. It's approved in the pediatric population. Have you used it in adults? Would you like to use it in adults? Maybe indirectly in comparison to mirtametinib?
Yeah. I hope I'm not breaking any rules here, but let's be honest, right? We all use a ton of off-label drugs, and in pediatrics especially. So if you consider the first MEK inhibitor trial for neurofibromatosis was done by a group of pediatric institutions. It was the pediatric branch of the National Cancer Institute and Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, places like that, Boston Children's. And so they all have exclusively pediatric practices, and that's where it all started. And so you've got a drug approved that treats plexiform neurofibroma well in people with NF. And if you've got a 24-year-old coming in with a ton of pain or cosmetic effect from a really awful plexiform neurofibroma, what are you going to do? You're going to reach for selumetinib. And so before mirtametinib's approval, I definitely treated people off-label with selumetinib. When I visited Canada for a talk last year, they were all using trametinib like crazy up there. I guess it's on the national formulary or something, but that's what they were all taking. So there's a lot of off-label use. And specifically, if you look at trametinib and the amount of off-label use those guys get for not even pursuing approval for their drug, it's pretty amazing.
You know, everybody always cautions about indirect comparisons, and yet a lot of times that's all we have, and we have to do the best we can.
Yes.
How do you see, particularly mirtametinib and selumetinib, is this sort of a letrozole and anastrozole thing where you can't really tell the difference, or are there real differences that you can see?
It's like a lot of things we do in medicine. The longer you've done it and the better you get at it, the better it turns out. So when I did my very first clinical trial with trametinib, man, we had all kinds of trouble. And then using selumetinib clinically, I used what I learned from trametinib, got things better, and mirtametinib was the last one to come. So they got to benefit from everything that we had learned from managing MEK inhibitors for years before that. So I'm really hesitant to draw any comparisons. Let's just say, I think that as long as you've got somebody who knows these drugs and knows how to manage them for a chronic use, that you're going to turn out fine.
So, I mean, I guess it's always easier to go with something that's approved. So I imagine mirtametinib is going to be brought in very quickly to adult patients. And I noticed one thing is that it's given for 2 years. How many people actually make it to 2 years?
A lot. 80% of the people on the trial who stayed on the trial rolled over to the long-term follow-up because they were getting benefit and their side effects were well controlled. So I think that's kind of a marquee that we should put over this, right? That patients with a chronic condition are able to stay on this medication chronically to control their condition.
I noticed, too, quite a few patients, I guess, I think it was 17%, had dose reductions because of tolerability issues. What are the common tolerability issues that lead to dose reductions or discontinuations with mirtametinib?
Yeah, and, you know, I'm not so scared of dose reduction because I've done dose reductions in a bunch of patients and continue to see good responses, as we do with many of these inhibitor, the NIBs out there. So, but the dose reductions were generally because of skin, heart, or nausea.
And remind me again about the cardiac issues.
Decreased ejection fraction. And so we do serial echocardiograms on these patients. And if we see a reduction in ejection fraction, we'll generally stop the drug until the ejection fraction improves. In my clinical practice, if I see them get back to normal, I'll restart at the dose they were on before. Many patients will continue and do just fine, but for those who then have a fall off again, they've earned themselves a dose reduction, and I'll go down by 25%, rounded off to whatever dose form is available.
And for patients who have the drug, either they make it to 2 years or they have it stopped, as you mentioned, like 20% before 2 years, do you see efficacy or do you ever retreat?
I don't stop. If I've got somebody with a big neurofibroma or a neurofibroma in a bad area, I'll continue. My longest patient on a MEK inhibitor right now is 7.5 years out.
But when you talked about in the mirdametinib trial, I guess you called it the observation period. I assume the drug
was stopped.
That was
2 years. No, it wasn't. At the end of 2 years, they could opt for the long-term follow-up phase. And in long-term follow-up, they continued to take the drug. And that's why duration of response hasn't been hit yet, because people are still taking the drug.
So it's really not 2 years. It's until...
Yeah, they have it's until they're done. It's
so
until
they're done. Then where did the two-year thing come? It was just like an arbitrary point you wanted to look at?
Yep. That was it. For purposes of the clinical trial, that's where they put it. There was a phase one or two before that that was much shorter. And you can guess that if it was shorter, the number of patients who had responses was lower. And it was purely for that reason, because they hadn't been on the drug long enough to see their response.
So this also reminds me of desmoid, because I also spent more than an hour and a half talking with an investigator. I never thought I could talk for 25 minutes about it, and we weren't even through. And that's the way I feel with you right now. But, you know, we have covered an awful lot. I imagine, you know, it's funny. I was trying to get ready for this by reading things, looking at available education things. I think this thing's going to be better than anything I could find. At least I can understand it a lot more. And maybe I missed some stuff out there, but your explanation is, you know, really very good and great to be able to follow. Anything you want to add to what we've talked about today? Any other sort of pearls, particularly, again, for a general medical oncologist? You mentioned so many things so far, but anything else you'd like to add to that?
No, I want them to pay attention to the fact that they want patients to stay on this for a long period of time. And so everything they can do to ameliorate the side effects from the drug in a proactive fashion, that's going to be really important. I talked about doxycycline, bleach baths, dietary management. If you educate patients or their families well about this, you're going to keep people on the drug. And one other point I wanted to make, remember that many patients with NF1 have a learning disorder. So if those patients are going to enter onto this trial and you're an adult medical oncologist, make sure that they've got a partner. Make sure they've got a partner so they can remain adherent to the regimen.
That's a great point. Do you see like tachyphylaxis to some of these tolerability issues, or they just continue?
Well, not right now. Right now we've had pretty good luck. I think the one thing that really stuck out to me early in my MEK inhibitor experience was fatigue. And some people get genuine fatigue, like you'd expect with many cancer therapies, but others get a fatigue of therapy. Taking a pill twice a day, every day, there's a therapeutic fatigue that sets in too. And so that requires some special attention also.
But these, sort of supportive care strategies you've talked about, you have to keep that going indefinitely.
Well, a lot of the skin stuff, if you can manage that effectively for the first 3 months or so, you're going to come out pretty golden. Likewise with nausea, and I've seen this with imatinib too. Some people will start with imatinib or dasatinib early and have a lot of nausea, and then a year into therapy, they forgot that they had it. So I think if you can help them through that period with antiemetics, dietary guidance, you'll keep them on the drug and they'll feel better later.
So the last thing I want to ask you about, as I did before we got started here, is I actually work with your dad, the famous Dr. Charles Martel, one of the really great leaders in GI oncology, very charismatic person. I can remember chatting with him a number of times. I'm curious how I think he was a GI. He was focused on GI, colon cancer, et cetera.
Carcinoid tumors late in life. Yeah.
Right. Right. And, you know, so instrumental, too, in terms of, you know, promoting clinical research. Just kind of curious how you ended up in oncology and particularly with this particular interest.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a two-part question, isn't it? But I started my career as a school teacher because I saw how hard my dad worked. He always had a stack of spreadsheets back when they were paper on the living room counter, on the living room table. And he would sit there night after night going through his spreadsheets, looking at how 5-FU worked, for instance. I remember sitting with him when he had a eureka moment that 5-FU might actually provide some benefit to people with colon cancer. But I went to school to be a school teacher because there was no way I was going to work that hard. And then after 3 years of being a school teacher, I had an opportunity come up and I took it. And that was going to medical school. And I had had some experiences along the way with childhood friends and others. And I wrote on my medical school application, I want to be a pediatric oncologist. And so once I embarked on my pediatric oncology career, areas of need became evident to me. And so the first area of need I saw was brain tumors. And within the brain tumor population in children, there are a lot of kids with optic glioma who had NF1. And I wanted to make life better for those kids. And then my reputation grew as far as taking care of these NF1 patients. And one day a mom walked in and it was the boy I showed you with the large plexiform neurofibroma of the leg. And she said, "Dr. Martel, I've been all over town. I've gathered up the specialists I need. And now I need you to be his oncologist because I'm aware of these new clinical trials that are coming up." And it became evident to me then that people weren't doing this out in the community. There were not enough NF specialists. So I wrote a business plan for my hospital system to start a comprehensive NF clinic at our hospital. And then subsequently in 2007, I was invited to come here to the University of Minnesota, where I have lab partners who are developing new therapies for NF. And now I've kind of faded out of brain tumors and given those to my youthful partners and spend all my time on NF, taking care of patients in my clinic and developing new therapies for the problems we encounter.
Amazing. What do you still see the 12-year-old boy?
I do.
How old is he now?
The one who was in multiple clinical trials is now in his mid-20s, and he works for a large biomedical company involved in their large development program. He's a very brilliant kid. It's very gratifying to know him and his family and to see what we've all gone through together. His sister went into biochemistry because she wants to find an answer too.
Wow, fascinating. All righty, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it and I learned so much. I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate that. And thanks for calling attention to this condition and these brand new therapies that are out there for your audience. I hope that it bears fruit and we make lives better for all these people. So thanks for your time.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Martel, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.